the goals of the company was to keep was to not mass produce. Is for hand built. We feel that's one of the selling points. A positive selling point is something that's hand built, Australian made, and have a worldwide distribution, but all direct sale. So that's something which is not an easy model, but it's what we're running with at the moment.
DeVore Fidelity, the show partner of Not an Audiophile, the podcast. DeVore Fidelity has become one of the most acclaimed high-end companies in the world. And having heard the loudspeakers many times, I know why. They're all still handcrafted in Brooklyn, New York. We love how this iconic brand captures the excitement and breath of the sound. Nothing brings you closer to the music than DeVore Fidelity. For a retailer near you, visit DeVoreFidelity.com. We are back, Not an Audiophile, episode 60, season 3. Today we speak to a smaller manufacturer. We speak to many manufacturers of varying sizes and global domination, I guess. In fact, we have quite a few of those celebrity status interviewees coming up over the next few episodes, and that will be great. Today, though, we talked to Russell Lenihan from Lenihan Brothers. They have been running in various forms, initially as Lenihan Audio, for just as many years as many of the extraordinarily well-known brands. They have very strong ideas on how things should be done, and from our point of view, we think we should let them have a crack, hear their story, and the way they believe it should be done, and that's exactly what we're going to do. Have a listen to Russell's thoughts on audio and the best way to pursue perfection. And we're back in the studio with Russell Lenihan today, one of the Lenihan brothers, and now the kingpin, perhaps.
Definitely the kingpin, although my older brother Michael would definitely disagree.
Yes.
But yes, I'm in control of things at the moment.
I'm in control. Hey, thank you for coming in today, Russell. We'd love to have a chat about all sorts of things, audio, including, of course, your own product, Lenihan Brothers loudspeakers, which you manufacture here in Australia. We'll talk about that quite a lot. In fact, I mean, we could just kick off on that.
Sure.
So you sell someone a pair of loudspeakers, they get them home, they're enjoying them, they have some friends over, they're enjoying the sound, they're listening to them. But they ask the guy the question, the guy that bought them from you, you know, why? Why did you buy Lenihan Brothers loudspeakers? Why didn't you buy XYZ? What do you think is in the mind of that new owner? What do you think they might have... What do you think they would say to their friend about they bought a pair? Your system one, as an example,
yeah.
Versus, say, I don't know, BMW 805s or something like that. What do you think is running through their mind?
Well, one of the things that I would like them to consider in the purchase is Australian made.
Okay.
I think that's a big thing.
Sure.
Australia's sort of sitting out on its own, part of Asia and all that sort of thing. But if you look at the global marketplace, I think there's a big market out there for quality. And in terms of Australian products, I think they're recognised around the world. We've got a lot of good manufacturers, particularly in hi-fi and electronics. So I just want to be part of that. I wanted to be part of the message that it's... hand-built in Australia, using as many Australian products as possible, although I think, as you may know, that we still have to source lots of stuff from overseas, parts and components.
Yes.
But the manufacture is all done here, and wherever we can, we use Australian products. So the cabinets are all Australian-made. We buy glue from Australia. Everything possible.
Sure.
Obviously the packaging, and only where we have to do we source from overseas. It's a good thing.
It is a good thing, and it's a pretty strong reason. In fact, I can see that being one good reason why the owner of your pair, a pair of your loudspeakers, would put that forward as probably one of the big things. Is there anything else that strikes you that they would sort of, you know, they might?
Absolutely.
Yes.
I don't know whether it would be called a legacy, but something that's the build quality is of sufficient standard that it's not going to fall apart. It's not going to look tatty. It's going to be easily maintained. And I think one of our first goals in terms of build and appearance is furniture grade quality. I think that's the type of thing, and we've actually improved upon that.
Okay.
So these are not just handmade; they're a combination of hand construction, but using the closest tolerance CNC machining as well. Combination of both.
I guess that's how modern manufacturing works. Yeah, there's a precision you can get these days that you probably when your brother Michael started what was Lenihan Audio?
Lenihan Audio, yes.
Many years ago, probably, what, 30 years ago or something, approximately?
30 years ago, and in the early 90s, we've been building speakers all our life, but he made it into his sole business early 90s.
Yeah, so I guess things have changed a little bit. I know things that I were doing in manufacturing in the 90s, I mean, it was really, you know, in the late 90s, I guess CNC was starting to be a thing, but you know, it's now not just a thing, it's de rigueur. There's no way you would even think about building an enclosure without having it machined on a machine, a fancy machine, to a very precise standard, which clearly you do. Nothing else? I'm thinking the way it sounds. That's got to be a big part of it, isn't it?
It's a massive part of it, and in our opinion, the current System 1 Blacks are the best speakers, the most neutral speakers, and we'll get to neutrality in a moment.
Sure.
That you can have in a small to medium room without requiring a subwoofer, and that was an important part of the equation.
Okay. Yeah.
Although people do tack subwoofers on in. Depends on what your goals are, but
yes,
there's absolutely no need. And one of the main goals was to create a speaker that was as neutral as possible.
Mm-hmm.
What I mean by neutral, and this following up on your question, is that can be driven by a whole range of different products,
mm-hmm,
according to your taste, and you can easily get your style of sound by changing your ancillary equipment in your hi-fi system.
Sure.
So if your speakers are relatively neutral, there's no such thing as perfect neutrality, by the way.
No.
But if you know that if you put a particular type of amplifier on it, you get a particular type of sound and it'll respond to that. And there's no surprises. The goal is to, for room dependent, of course, and we'll get to room acoustics and room soon, but if the room's not mucking up the sound you'll get from our speakers will be exactly what you get from the rest of your system. It'll reproduce it accurately.
Yeah. Okay. So that's a design philosophy, if you like, is it? The neutrality? That's a goal.
It is, and there's a couple of very strong elements in that, and one of the biggest elements in neutrality is low self-noise by the cabinet. So only the drivers, the selected drivers that you're using are, of course, along with the crossover network and the dispersion pattern, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
But the drivers speak only, not the boxes.
So when you say self-noise, how would you explain that?
Self-noise is noise coming from the loudspeaker system that is in addition to what's coming out of the drivers.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So all the stuff you don't want,
basically. All the stuff you don't want. However, we know that's not necessarily – that's our model, but we know many loudspeaker manufacturers that do actually use the cabinets as a tuning option.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons they might do that is because the sacrifices, the cost of having a completely inert cabinet is both high in terms of both mass, shipping, as well as cost and material. materials. So yeah, it's not an easy one.
No. No, well, it's one of the many complexities of bringing a loudspeaker to market, I guess, is that, you know, where does your philosophy lie and where do you put your compromises, I guess? And in fact, the speakers you saw downstairs when you walked in are exactly the kind of box that you're talking about, where we used birch ply because it, when damped in a particular way, gives a kind of the resonance that remains is of low enough frequency that it's almost a pleasant adjunct to the sound. And you clearly are going a different way, or have gone a different way, I should say. And I think Michael always has. You know, the cabinet's always been, as inert as possible, I guess, from my understanding.
Yeah, it is. And as I said, it's a particular philosophy, it is a technical attempt at getting the sound that you want.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it's to not, and this, this is not meant to sound a bit crazy, but our speakers don't sound good.
They sound amazing.
They don't sound amazing either. They sound absolutely as neutral as possible for the signal going in.
Right.
So that gives real problems because it's easy to dial out add some little nice resonances that adds pleasantness to the music signal you're getting. And that's just not our goal.
No.
So for example, why I say that is because if people like valve amplifier signatures, and there's not just one, but in general they're a bit softer, more bloomy, more 3D, that comes across exactly correctly on our speakers.
Yeah, okay, yeah. So as a matter of interest, just going sideways slightly, so the clients that you've got or Michael's had over the years, do they have a preference in amplifiers? Have you made a note about that? Like, are they solid state, Class A, Class AB,
yes.
Tubes, Class D? What are they like? Yeah. Or is it just everything?
Bit of everything.
Yeah.
And in our feedback from the previous owners under Lenihan Audio, when we look at the amplifiers and the systems they use, there's a lot of differences. Now, if we go back to Michael's previous work under Lenihan Audio, he used to sell amplifiers like he used to be a Primaluna dealer.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So quite a few of his customers used Primaluna. He also used some of the early Class D amplifiers.
Sure.
Certainly not as good as the current ones, but a certain type of sound.
Yeah.
And the speakers reflected that sound.
Yeah.
So a lot of Class ABs. I myself run a, in terms of development, I run a Class D amp from March Audio.
Mm-hmm.
In Western Australia, fantastic amp, but it's a
there
class.
There you go, Alan. Good ad there.
Alan, mate, I like your stuff, and I've used one of your amps for development. But it does have a particular sound. I'm not saying it doesn't.
Okay.
And the other amps I used, a couple of amps, one was a, I still use, some Monarchy Class A, zero feedback, full Class A monoblocks.
Yeah, right, yeah.
They're actually single-ended, not even push-pull transistor. They're single-ended transistor, zero feedback, full Class A.
Okay.
And so...
What do they sound like?
Well, I think they're absolutely amazing. CC Poon from San Francisco used to make them. He's retired now, but we still have correspondence. And I'm actually investigating with him whether we can continue the manufacture of them.
Okay.
And I can import them into Australia. That's a long way in front. But that gives.
There you go. There's a scoop there, folks.
Yes, a scoop.
Single-ended transistor amps.
Single-ended transistor, yes. Similar to some of Nelson Pass's early amps.
Capacitively coupled output, or what? How do you get the signal out of the amp without any DC offset?
That's a good question. I can't answer that one.
All right, moving right along.
Yeah.
You mentioned room acoustics.
Yeah.
It's a pet subject of mine. I think it's a pet subject of a lot of people, but I think it's because of necessity. I also find it to be hugely intriguing because every single acoustic space that you walk into is different, right? The one we're in now versus the one downstairs versus standing outside. It's all, you know, and yet your brain does a pretty good job, your ear brain, of sort of equalising and making it all kind of similar sounding. But it gives you a headache if it's a difficult hearing environment or listening environment, because your brain is working so hard to kind of decipher what's going on. So there is a huge advantage in obviously improving the acoustics of a room, particularly for, you know, listening to stereos, but even just for living in. I mean, we've all been into those grandiose houses you walk in and they're three stories high when you walk in the front door, and it's like being in a really poor quality church. In the sense that, you know, it's a big space, but acoustically it's very reverberant and it's kind of tiring to speak in even and have a conversation. But moving back to stereo-related acoustics, have you got kind of, I mean, you touched on it. You made the statement that, you know, if the speakers were in a reasonably neutral acoustic room, that they would sound... March Audio. March Audio is a proud episode sponsor of the Not an Audiophile podcast. With a mission to provide superb technical performance and exceptional sound at modest prices, Alan March has designed a range of power amplifiers, a preamplifier, and a selection of stunning loudspeakers that you should check out now at marchaudio.com. Neutral.
Yeah.
What is a normal listening room, do you think? Like, for Lenihan Brothers, what is the prescribed space, I guess, that you hope your loudspeakers end up in?
Yeah, well, on our user manual, we do have pay a lot of attention to room acoustics and setup.
Okay.
Because every room's different, as you know.
Yes.
I mean, we're sitting in a reasonably lively room at the moment.
Mm.
The thing is, the ear-brain combination is extremely good at detecting that make allowances for the fact of where we are. But when we're listening to music, we don't really want those necessarily to intrude. So we want to have a room, in my opinion, that is should be treated ideally, but many aren't. The good news is that most rooms have living people live in them, and they're not specified living spaces. So most rooms do have bits and pieces. They've got perhaps bookcases in them, they've got lounges, they've got carpets, etc.
Yeah.
And they're all help. So in many times you don't really have a big issue, I don't believe, in most rooms for reflection issues. I think that's okay. It's really just the standing wave issues and room nodes which can cause problems, because that's very hard to get rid of. There's a lot more energy down there, wideband energy down lower, and that's harder to deal with. Excuse me. But even then, people get used to their room.
Well, that's right. They absolutely get used to
the room, and they know the difference. But the thing that's really important to me is that if you do some fairly small changes to your room so that you're reasonably comfortable, you don't have massive reflections, you don't have massive standing waves, can't get rid of all of them, by the way, but simply moving the speakers around in the room can make a massive difference.
Yes.
So I totally believe that if you simply make a little bit of effort, move your speakers around, see where they sit. We've even got the old-fashioned, I'll use this sexist term, but I hope people understand, the wife acceptance factor. Now, it's not about wives. There's many people who, doesn't matter what they are, what their sex, their gender, their listening preferences, people have different preferences. But what I do have find is that
some people
value the aesthetics over the listening environment. So what do you do? How do you design a pair of speakers to fit into an aesthetic that's got value for the visuals? What do you do?
Yeah, well, that's for you to answer. So you've decided to make it.
I can answer that.
A solid timber enclosure with a sculptured baffle, and that's the recipe that you've got. That's what you offer.
Well, I'm going to slightly change that.
Sure.
The current speakers are not solid timber.
Right.
They're a solid timber baffle. They're generally some of the hardest woods, hardwoods you can get for the baffle, severely braced, but the cabinets are not made out of wood.
Well, hang on, hold that thought, because I think I have a question preloaded for that. Swinging back to acoustics for a second. So you've in your manual, your owner's manual, you've got some suggestions. You say move the speakers around. Everyone says that. No one really, for the purposes of, I guess, for some of the listeners who are less au fait with maybe what's the right place to put the speakers, what do you feel is the right place to stick the loudspeakers in the room, and then turn where's a good place to sit to listen to them?
It's an excellent question, and there's many answers, and so...
No, I only want the one answer.
One answer?
Make it simple.
Well, the one answer is easy. Buy our speakers and stick them in your room and get the best system you can to drive them, and it's all done.
I thought you were going to say, buy our speakers, we'll come out and we'll put them in the correct positions and tell you where to sit.
We can do that. That's a service that we can offer.
I mean, it's which brings us to another subject, the fact that you do sell direct to the consumer, to the end user. Terrible term, I hate that term, but it does describe accurately, let's face it, the person who's actually ultimately owning them and putting them in their lounge room. But we'll also come back to that. So those two things. I'm going to come back to your cabinets, but also the reasons why you sell direct. So you're saying most acoustics you feel out of the box in most people's, I guess, lounge rooms they're putting them in are good enough. Is that kind of...
Look, a domestic environment with clutter and stuff...
But what if there's no clutter?
That's right. So they got problems. So there are solutions. So if you've got a very reflective room, particularly the sideboards, and one of the design decisions about our speakers are that they're not limited in terms of their treble dispersion. In fact, the dispersion all round is quite good. And as you know, treble becomes increasingly more directive as the frequencies go up.
Mm-hmm.
So our intention is to not limit that, to not have any directivity indicators for the speaker, so that it does radiate quite wide in the treble, which is not usual because a lot of people are now using waveguides or horns.
Yeah, it's very, very unfashionable to do. In fact, it would be incredibly unfashionable, as I think you're suggesting, that you're philosophically less concerned with directivity than just about anything else. That seems to be just people go on and on and drone on and on and on about, oh, we have this very even directivity across, you know, a broad range of frequencies, which some of the nicest sounding loudspeakers in the world simply do not have. So what are your thoughts on that? You're implying you don't care that as much as some.
Well,
I'm sure you care. But
We do care, but we're saying don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. So why would you limit the dispersion of your speaker or try and limit it if that's not the way to go in our opinion? The opinion is let the drivers do their thing, look at as wide band of dispersion as possible, and make changes to where they sit in the room is by far the more preferable option. So with a speaker with wide treble dispersion, which ours do have, obviously if you direct them straight onto a hard wall at the sides, you might have some issues to address. So we have different answers. That is the way the speakers react in the room. Or should we put additional damping? So in the room.
Yeah.
So it is an issue. So if you've got reflective sidewalls, then you don't direct the speaker, you tilt the speaker in more to get the balance.
I was assuming that's what you mean, like you tow them in.
You tow them in more. Yeah, so the other option is to limit the directivity of the speaker itself.
Yes.
So you get less room problems. That is an approach.
Mm.
It's not the approach that we use. We find better to let the speaker do its thing and move them into the correct space into the room so that you get the best overall sound and energy dispersion throughout. So, of course, the problem is that if your loudspeaker system is in a room that you want it to look good, you want it to be perfect, then that's definitely a consideration. So if you're considering your domestic space, that's a consideration. Our speakers tend to work best out in the room.
Yes.
And depending upon the sidewall reflectivity, they tend to work best tilted in a touch more.
Yeah, okay.
It's just a different philosophy.
Well, it is, and it's very unfashionable, but at the same time, some of the things that are fashionable at the moment were incredibly unfashionable 5 or 10 years ago.
Absolutely.
Things like, for instance, speaking of directivity, and you mentioned the word waveguide. Not so much waveguides, but I am getting one after another interpretations of a Devon Turnbull OJAS style speaker in my Instagram on a daily basis. Yet another person has built a, speaking of plywood earlier, in this case, undamped thick plywood. Horrible idea, in my opinion, although it's a great material, and we'll get to materials in a second.
Yeah, we will.
Even in that use case where you use a PA style speaker where you build it out of 3/4 plywood or something, yeah, and you brace it a bit, but you don't try to tone down the natural, fairly resonant nature of the ply. But they build this bass box, they stick a 10-inch or a 12-inch driver in it, and then they've got some kind of horn, not really a waveguide, some kind of horn sitting on top, literally naked on top of the box, plugged in as, I'm going to say, Devon Turnbull style, where they've got a pair of binding posts on the top of the box and a bit of scrappy-looking twisted wire, which is so unfashionable. If someone had done it 10 years ago, and I guess when Devon did it the first time, people kind of thought, well, that's weird. To me, you know, it's just a reinvention of something we were probably doing in the early 70s, but it's become super fashionable now, is my point. And yet it's got all sorts of problems. If you talk about diffraction and stuff, I mean, you've got, I mean, well, maybe not, because the directivity of that horn is, you know, is so directional that maybe there isn't a diffraction problem with off the top of the box. But what are your thoughts on this? I mean, fashion in hi-fi, in this case, a fashion that clearly from a high-end engineering point of view is kind of flawed.
I don't view it as flaws. I view it as intention, I suppose, design intention. And you get results when you do that. So I don't think anything's necessarily better than another.
Yes.
But the one thing which I do think is better is that if you've got some drive units and they're producing sound, that's all you want to hear.
Don't mess with it.
Don't mess with it, no.
Does that imply, jumping ahead, does that imply that your crossovers are relatively simple, straightforward sort of thing?
No.
Unleashing the raw energy of the drivers?
No, not at all. It's in particular, first of all, in my opinion, is that the ear is more sensitive to amplitude variation, wideband amplitude variation.
Sure.
Is it because it takes into, and if you look at the way any loudspeaker system measures in a room, there'll be lumps and bumps anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
So the ear is reasonably sensitive to amplitude variations. What it's not sensitive to is a combination of phase change and quick amplitude variations, because that's not a natural thing. The ear is pretty good at noticing how
so it is
change.
So it is, sorry, I don't know whether you, maybe I heard you wrong. So the ear is sensitive or is not sensitive to, you said quick, you said phase?
It's sensitive to quick changes.
Yes, yeah, okay. Yeah,
but
yeah,
not
yeah.
as sensitive to broadband changes over a wide spectrum, because we can take that into account. Because when our hearing is, we're talking about hearing
it
before.
Because the brain balances
the
it
brain
out
The brain can balance
you.
It out, but it can't, it has, in my opinion, has a problem with quick changes or quick phase changes.
And when you
or
mean,
quick
when you say
changes.
Quick, you mean quick in the sense of a swept sine wave.
Correct,
scenario.
Narrow band.
Yes,
narrow
band. Yes, a narrow band, okay.
So we're getting back to crossovers. So the crossovers are designed to be as less severe and as smooth as possible throughout the range.
Yes.
And in fact, the slopes the slopes change. I won't give, divulge the crossover philosophy, but the slopes change throughout the crossover period, which for any pair of dynamic drivers sort of has to. I mean, the theoretical, you know, fourth order or third order or second order.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's, well, yeah, that's a kind of a silly throwaway statement, isn't it? Because, I mean, we don't even know whether that's an acoustic slope or an electrical slope. So.
Exactly correct. Yeah. So it's a combination of those things. So
yeah.
Without divulging the exact philosophy.
No, not asking you to. But I do have a question, and I'm not going to, we're still going to come back to cabinets.
Sure.
And that other thing that I've forgotten.
We'll get to it.
Well, we will, because I'll probably have a break in a second and I'll go back and listen and remind myself what it was. But the other thing that you're talking about, that we're talking about the crossover, is the Brisbane Hi-Fi. I mean, the clue is kind of in the title. The store is located in Brisbane and they sell hi-fi. But it's not just another hi-fi store. It's kind of like some kind of tropical weekend away in paradise. The people are friendly, there's lots of interesting things to see and listen to in this case, and the drinks are tasty. I highly recommend Brisbane Hi-Fi for a different hi-fi purchasing experience. brisbanehifi.com.au. So you're very generous on your website, which if I'm going to give you a quick plug, lenehanbrothers.com.au for those listening. So Lenehan, L-E-N-E-H-A-N, brothers.com.au, go and have a look. It's a fair bit of information there. And one of the things that you've got on there, which I don't think anyone else really does, is, if I find the right page here again, is you describe your System 1 black, which is the thing we're going to talk about in a second as far as cabinet construction, I believe, is where you're headed. But you've got crossover construction, and you list everything that's basically on the crossover as far as what it is. And the thing that caught my eye, was that. But then further down it says, you actually list what your drive units are. No one does that.
Yep.
I mean, no one does that. That's very transparent of you, and I think there would be people that would appreciate that, although they are very expensive drivers, and so maybe...
They are, and the history of the last couple of years has been amazing as well in terms of the cost of those.
Yes. You've got these Sayaz, or Cs, whoever, yeah, however you, whichever school you went to, when you learnt Norwegian, but the... XL 19 centimetres, very European dimension. We'll say 190 mil. We live in Australia.
Yeah.
Magnesium graphene cone.
Yes.
It's a crazy cone in a way. My understanding is, I mean, it's not like it's a new thing. It's been around a while, I guess. But there's two things about that. One is that my understanding is that it implies that it is, it says on the XL, on the Sayers website that cone is cast. It's not formed. It's not vacuum formed. It's not laid up like says graphene. But the graphene is not the cone. The graphene is the coating, or vice versa. What explain the cone? And then I've got a question for you that's directly related to the crossover. And when you describe the cone, you might tell the audience why. Why use that cone?
Or not
answer the question.
I'll answer
the driver.
I'll answer it as best I can. So when you use, and by the way, my brother did most of this work in terms of the original research on different cone materials,
sure.
And all cone materials,
and that's what I meant when I say you may not choose to answer because you're not the designer.
Yeah, I'm not.
But you clearly have a broad knowledge of audio, though. So.
Well, the old cones by CS was a straight magnesium cone.
Yes. Yeah.
And it corroded.
Oh, and it corroded.
Yes.
Okay. So. It was cast then. It would be if it was magnesium.
I'm not sure the construction method.
Okay, but it corroded. So is that where the graphene comes in? It's
correct.
Really just a way to protect
it's graphene coated.
Yeah, okay.
And one of the things about magnesium.
And what's graphene? Is it some kind of resin or something?
No, graphene is a different form of carbon.
Yeah, okay.
Graphene is, I think it's a multi layered, not a carbon fiber. Carbon fiber is woven. This is a layered carbon graphene.
Yes.
That's my understanding. Okay. I don't have the full technical information on that.
So what was the, forgetting the technicalities on the chemical structure, what's the acoustic performance reason for choosing that cone? Do you know?
Yes, I do. It has very good the cone itself, very good internal self-damping. That's number one.
Yeah.
So you don't get extraneous vibrations. Okay. And that's one of the reasons why people use paper cones as well, because it's got good internal self-damping.
Indeed, yeah.
But certainly the combination of magnesium and graphene is extremely well internally damped. But it still has natural resonances, of course, any driver does.
Yes.
And it has been a smidgen tough to deal with, and that's why the proprietary crossover.
Well, that's where I'm going, of course, is that looking at the on-axis response chart of that driver, it's probably best described as diabolical. There's no part of it that's flat. There's dips and peaks. And so that's kind of why I'm asking the question, because it puts the onus on the designer, like, right from the start. How do I, whatever the advantages are of this cone material, how the hell do I get it out of it? You know, like, I even wrote down what the problems are, because I'm like, wow, there's, so that you mount the European Alps at about 4K and the response goes up to basically, you know, I don't know, the Gross Glockner at 5K. I mean, it's a very high peak.
It is.
And then there's a huge null, if you like, or a very steep drop-off prior to that, like at about, I don't know, 1,500, 2K, and it just falls away, 8 dB. Now, you may not have the answers of how you deal with that in your crossover or how you deal with it maybe with the shape of the baffle and the arrangement of the drivers on the front of the box or something like that, but they are some fairly significant bumps to deal with. So thoughts on that? Your brother's a genius, obviously, is the answer.
Well, it's not just flat frequency response is very important, and these measure pretty flat.
Yeah, okay.
Pretty flat. And, of course, we've had to deal with that resonant peak at 4 to 5K, wherever it is. So we've used proprietary techniques to do that. And the bottom line is that it's the peak is not an issue technically, nor audibly. That's the result of the crossovers.
Okay.
And it's not a typical, as I mentioned, it's got a variety of, the crossover deals with a variety of different slopes throughout the crossover region.
Yes, yep.
And in particular, of course, to get rid of that resonant peak.
Yes, yeah.
But the resonant peaks, you damp the resonant peak, that's what damping is.
Mm-hmm.
As long as it's, in this case, narrow band damping.
It's more of a breakup mode than a resonant peak, is it? Although I guess it's the cone. I guess the cone material. No expert on
this.
Well,
a breakup is just a series of resonant peaks.
Yeah, okay.
That's what a breakup is.
Okay, so it's sort of. But is it a combination of the cone? I mean, the cone material makes that resonant peak clearly worse, doesn't it? I mean, it's than say a paper cone you mentioned earlier, which will have a relatively benign, gentle breakup mode compared with this cone, But the advantages of the cone material in other areas of performance are such that it's worth
absolutely
persisting with.
Speed and rigidity, you just got to deal with the breakup modes.
Yeah.
And the frequency response is actually not really an issue, it's just good design to get a flat frequency response.
Yep.
But yes, I agree with you, the breakup mode was something that had to be dealt with and it has been...
A pest?
No, not a pest. It was obviously through my older brother's original design dealt with completely. So it's...
I'm not implying... I have heard the loudspeaker, as you know, and it doesn't sound like it's got any kind of, you know, non-dealt with response anomalies at all. It does sound quite, you know, linear, you know. There's no worries there, which is...
Linear is good. I like the word linear.
Oh, linear is one of my favourite words. I got others.
It's good.
They
are very linear.
Yeah. They've got a certain sound. And maybe that sound is, like you say, maybe that sound is that they don't have a sound. I don't know. I'm not sure.
Well, you can't tell if they have a sound, can you? Because no. You've got to hook them up to equipment.
Well,
the intention is to engineer them
because
so they have no sound.
Yeah, well, the thing is I haven't heard them in my own system. And that,
no.
So therefore, in other words, I've not done a review, so I'll pass no further comment. I mean, we could jump sideways. I think that, yeah, and one of the things, okay, there were, the other thing that we were going to go to was the cabinet material,
yep.
Which I think we'll cover now, but the other thing was the fact that you sell direct. And where I was going with that just then is that I guess you have places where people can go and listen, but let's go back to the cabinet material because
yep.
Now I'm going to quote what you say on your website because I love this expression. I don't know whether you sat around and had some kind of long involved meeting about thinking this expression up, but you've described the material that you've described the material in the System 1 Black as phenolic resin brackets organically loaded for damping. I love the expression organically loaded. I have no idea what that means. It sounds a bit loaded. So tell us what we sort of know what phenolic resin is, I think, but I guess it comes in different varieties. Talk about that material and why, and what are the advantages or disadvantages, if any?
Phenolic resin has been around for a long time. The original one, it's one of the original composites and artificially manufactured solids.
Yes,
and it's one people would know it most likely as Bakelite.
Yes.
The old phones.
Yes, yes.
That's Bakelite. But that's just straight phenolic resin.
Yeah.
So Bakelite can be a bit brittle and resonate a bit much.
Yes.
So the material that we use is layers and layers of organic material.
Right.
And it can be either paper or cotton is the most usual type of organic material. That's used to layer into the phenolic resin when it's set, which gives it massive internal damping, even more so than phenolic resin itself, and also much greater strength, torsional strength, along certain planes.
Yeah.
So it's incredibly good structural material.
Yes.
And it's also incredibly well damped.
If it's the material I'm thinking of, it's also an utter bastard to machine.
But we have proprietary techniques. I had to buy special. So it's not easy to machine.
No.
I had to buy special equipment for it.
Okay.
To do it. And we do it in house. My son builds them.
Okay.
Well, I assist with him, but he's the primary builder. And lots of failures through machining phenolic. Resin is not necessarily an easy thing to do.
It's kind of brittle in a way at some point, isn't it? It just sort of it chips a bit or something.
It's brittle by itself.
Yes.
The compound that we use is less brittle.
Yeah, I've got no idea what you're using, of course. Is it something you don't make the phenolic resin panel yourself, I presume?
No, we don't.
Or do you?
No, we don't make it ourselves.
Okay.
It's Australian sourced.
Okay.
And this particular phenolic resin we use is not cotton layered, this is paper layered.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, all right.
So it's got incredible internal damping, way superior to anything
it does.
Else we know. And
bloody heavy though, right?
It's very heavy. If the hardest of hardwoods, say some ironbarks, some Australian ironbarks, they might top out at, I don't know, 9 to 1100 kilo per cubic meter.
Yep.
This phenolic is 1500 to 1600.
Yeah, I was thinking it's something like that. Yeah,
something
yeah,
like
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
And aluminium's something like 20 something. So aluminium's not well self damped. This has got far greater internal self damping.
Yes.
Than straight aluminium.
Yes. Yeah, it's an interesting material, and not many people use it, do they?
No one that I know of.
Well, we use it. That's why I know about it.
For speakers?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't know that.
But only in a couple of simple areas in one particular small model, our FR35. We use it as the trim on the front, which I won't bore you with because it's not an ad for Delacorde. But we do use it as the rear baffle, but it's stamped with a piece of, you know, proprietary material.
Yeah.
MDF offcut. And it's
all very proprietary.
Well, what we glue them together with is proprietary, and it works very nicely. But yeah, that's the only reason I know anything about it. And it's a counter machine. Oh, well, it's not that hard to machine if you've got a fresh bit, right? But, you know, it chews through the bits. But it's a great material. I think I know why people don't use it, because it's a mongrel to deal with, and it's expensive, right?
It's expensive.
And it's heavy to ship if you were building a whole box out of it like you are. So you're a very brave man. So tell us a bit more about that. When you've got your standard speaker, your system one,
yeah,
which is a weird, sorry to say weird, unusual construction in itself, in that you use solid timber. No one really does that either. Well, there's a bit of a fashion back with solid timber to some degree, isn't there? Like, there's a few people overseas using it, very few locals, because weirdly in Australia there is no timber, right? We don't have timber. We leave it in the forests. Europeans and Americans cut it down.
Yeah.
Probably because they have more trees, right? They can spare a few. We just have a desert. So, yeah, if we built speakers out of sand, now then we'd have a free resource.
Oh, I've done that before. I've done sand-filled enclosures when the old Bailey transmission lines in the old days.
Well, sand, we could talk about that. That has its uses. But we do have plenty of sand. What we don't have is a lot of trees. But we have some great hardwoods, right? So you would say hardwood, and that's what you use in your solid timber boxes.
Yes.
How do you feel the difference? What's the difference in sound between a solid timber enclosure and the way you do it?
Yeah.
And your black enclosure, which is built from the phenolic resin?
Well, to us, there's a significant difference. We wouldn't have moved that way unless it was better.
You're implying that's all you're doing now. Is that?
That's our only. We've got a floor standard in development. We've only got the one. We've got stocks of the old solid wood.
Oh, so the solid timber is done. It's
we're not using that anymore.
Oh wow. Okay. No. Except for the baffle. Yeah. Okay.
Which we've found is to be fair, is it's an easier component to brace. The baffle,
and
it's a single piece, so that's not an issue.
Yeah.
Although we can also build solid cabinets, including the baffle, in phenolic resin, but timber front baffles, and we use ironbark, or spotted gum.
Okay,
but ironbark it's the densest of the Australian timbers, and some of the red ironbark we get from Coffs Harbour Hardwoods,
yes.
Put in a plug. Fantastic people. And by the way, one of the people we deal with at Coffs Harbour Hardwoods is the name of Brian Crix, K-R-I-X.
Is that right?
He happens to be the related to Scott Crix from Crix Audio.
Wow, Scott
and
Crix.
And they know, Scott's a great guy, and so is Brian at Coffs Harbour Hardwoods. So
yeah,
it's Scott, a bit of plug.
Scott is a great guy, and we did a great episode with Scott about 10 or so episodes ago. Yeah. Look it up. Probably the largest Australian speaker manufacturer ever, and probably the longest lived, I'd guess, you know, because 50 years since they started on their dining room table. So you use the super hard hardwood, but so when you first built the phenolic resin, if that's organically loaded.
Yeah, yeah.
When you built the first sample, what were your thoughts on the sound? What'd you hear or not hear?
Something quite amazing. Mm. We heard a quietness which was unusual, because our thoughts were that the original wood and steel lined and steel and aluminium lined enclosures, which we used previously, the System 1s, we thought they were exceptional.
Yes.
I think they are exceptional. But these ones add a quiet to the sound, and surprisingly, what we've done is, because they're thinner material, this is intentional.
Yeah.
Because of the level of damping required and the bracing required,
yep.
They actually go substantially lower in the bass. It's really surprised us. When I say substantially lower, not necessarily in frequency response, because the cabinet volume is roughly the same.
Yeah.
It's just the damping. The damping is significantly increased. So we had to adjust the tuning of the speaker just marginally, but effectively the same. But the new black version, the Phenolic Resin cabinets, are, in our opinion, substantially in front of the other ones.
Okay.
And we did not expect that, to be honest. One of the reasons we went to different materials because of the difficulty in working with large cabinets of solid timber.
Oh, yeah.
It's not an easy construction thing to do. And we had warping issues and failures. That's okay. We're not selling the failures, but we did have failures. So we had to come to a technique to get the wooden speakers done perfectly.
Okay.
Which we did, but these ones are better. They're more consistent dimensionally, if that's a better word. They don't move.
No, well, they wouldn't. No, because that stuff is never going anywhere.
They don't
anywhere.
Move hot or cold, wet or dry.
No. On that note, Russell, we will be back after a quick break.
Thanks. Thanks, Andrew.
I was just breezing through the SoundstageAustralia.com website and was genuinely amazed at just what Edgar and his team have been reviewing lately. Onkyo Icon Series, Griffin, JBL Summit, Harbeth Actives, Moon River Phono Stage, and on it goes. Yeah, SoundstageAustralia.com. Go and take a look. Let's do some quick history and then look at how you go about selling these things and why, and then other thoughts on general audio stuff. Martin is the other brother, which we've failed to mention poor old Martin so far. I mean, he just sweeps the floor and packs the boxes.
You know, no, he doesn't. Not always. Oh, he's valuable.
He's valuable. Okay. Yes, the Cricks episode 43, as it turns out. I think we've got more episodes up our sleeve than we thought. It's actually it's a great episode, just like this one. So, Russell, you sell direct. Lots of people sell direct these days. You don't subcontract your retail requirements out to a professional retailer such as our neighbours across the driveway or people in, you know, Sydney, Melbourne or Singapore or London. Because I'm sure you sell speakers around the world. Certainly, I'm sure you have no problem with exporting your product anywhere that it needs to go. But why have you chosen to sell direct?
It's a very good question. Partly tradition. That is the way that when Lennon & Audio was selling their speakers in the previous decades, they would sell direct.
Okay.
And it's a good model. The other thing is the goals of the company was to not mass produce, is for hand built. We feel that's one of the a positive selling point is something that's hand built, Australian made, and have a potential worldwide distribution, but all direct sale. So that's something which is not an easy model. But it's what we're running with at the moment. I am in contact with a few retailers, and we do have that option which to run retail.
Sure.
And I've already been in contact with the audio tailor and Gold Coast Hi-Fi down on the Gold Coast. So we're looking at potential retail sales, but at the moment we're sticking with the direct sale model.
Mm-hmm. I guess it keeps you more in the loop with what the customer wants. I guess as an example, you control the whole process from beginning to end, but it's a considerable time sink, though, isn't it?
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. I think the intention was to expand the sales model from what my brother Michael did when it was Lenahan Audio, because he's a real guru type of person. Mm-hmm. He knows a lot of stuff. He's very intelligent, and his way is the only way to Michael, which is totally fine. Sorry, Mike, but there you go. His way is the only way, which I'm totally comfortable with. That's a way of doing business.
Sure.
And I know of many people in the hi-fi industry that seem to claim that theirs is the only real way to go about things. I'm not quite the same, even though I've got a very identifiable goal of what our products want to be,
sure,
and sound like and are built like. Mm-hmm. I think the distribution model is more ambitious than what Michael's was. We want to sell to new people.
Yeah, well, yeah.
We don't want to probably, culture.
You
culture,
need to sell to new people. Everyone does,
you need
I guess.
To sell yeah, to new yeah, people.
Yeah.
And not just those that belong to the old family of Australian people that think a certain person or product is a guru. So I've already been in contact with all of Michael's old customers, of course, and quite a lot of them
yes.
won't go anywhere else apart from Michael Speakers because Michael is the magic man.
Ooh, so we're touching on a little bit of a cult following there, is
a little
right?
bit, but that's well-deserved. Michael's incredible. He's my older brother. He's incredibly intelligent and intuitive, and he doesn't do things by the book. He throws his own method in.
Yeah, yeah.
But that develops a following of a certain type of buyer.
Yes.
I want to expand that. I wanted the product to speak by itself, not from me. That's just a different model. I wanted someone to come in and listen to the speakers and go, okay.
So I guess that which leads me to sort of my thought and my concern always with selling direct is how do you get the loudspeakers in front of people? This is working on the principle that the number one reason someone would buy a loudspeaker is because it sounds yummy to them. How do you and this is going to maybe end up sounding like an ad, but how do you do that? You've got people somewhere, or you've got offices, or you've got...
Yeah, we've probably been a little bit slow in that, and that's I take that on board. That's my responsibility because I thought that the model of listening spaces initially on the Eastern Seaboard, Australian Eastern Seaboard, would be sufficient. So people can go into... We'd have demonstration homes, people that would demonstrate the speakers for us.
Yes.
Under a business model, of course, but demonstrate the speakers for us in the home environment.
Yes.
And that's proved a touch more elusive, particularly as we've lost some of the people that we had. For example, our Melbourne connections moved to Armidale. So we're on the lookout for some new people in Melbourne, as an example.
I mean, is that a whole potential business model in itself, rather than so you've really got sell direct, which is if you look at say how Bukart does it, you just order the things. You take a punt based on some YouTube reviewer's opinion, which you know. I mean, there are really no bad speakers anymore, are there? Really? I mean, there's kind of no excuse. No. I mean, maybe there is. I mean, there's certainly some I see on Instagram that are clearly bad, but. You know, but this is a well-engineered product you've got, and then so is Bukart as an example. So there's no demo facility. You just order the thing, and I guess their thing is they give you their 45-day, you know, no questions asked return policy, which is pretty generous.
Well, we have a 90-day.
Well, wow, that's uber generous. Okay, so really,
people aren't going to return them.
That's the ploy, right?
That's the ploy. They've got to be good, and they are.
That's right. If they've had them for 90 days, their hearing has adjusted by then, no matter what. Not that it needs to. I'm not saying that, but you know what I mean. So that's okay. So that's part of it. So you do that.
We do.
You offer the 90-day, no questions asked return policy, which is probably seems to be a little bit too generous, but from the point of view of what. You know, what the hell do you then do with the speakers that are returned, I guess? But I guess they end up, I don't know, do they, I mean, do you, I don't know. What do you do with them?
We haven't had any speakers returned.
Well, there you go. Well, that's what you do with them. Okay, so you've got that policy, which is super generous. And then, so the other thing I was thinking is, but do you have some kind of small commissioned, you know, listening stations around the world, basically, where people buy them and then...
No, we don't. So that's stage two.
Okay.
Absolutely. So
that, I didn't mean that necessarily you had it now, but is that the thought though?
It is the thought.
Yeah.
So as is the retail idea. So
yeah, sure.
The retail, as I said, there's a couple of irons in the fire with retail, but then everything changes. First of all, your profit margins, the cost of the speakers. Where do you wish to pitch the retail price? So when you go retail, you've got to at least have a reasonable idea of what the retail price is going to be. Of course you do. You're yes. selling them wholesale in that case. And then you've got a different set of competitors. And so you've got to research where they're competing against and what they offer.
Do you? That's kind of where I went with question number one is you've got Bowers & Wilkins, owns a huge corporation. So they've got all sorts of scale. You know, they can build something. But the fact is that the particular loudspeaker I referred to is hand-built in England. So it's not a cheap place to build anything. People do the same thing they do here, which is they stand around playing with their phone all day. So they've got all of the same problems with efficiencies and so forth that we have making anything in Australia or America or probably Germany or wherever. Anywhere at China. I'm sure in China there are no phones at work, I suspect. I don't know. Maybe they're all playing with their phones as well.
It could be.
It could be.
We don't know.
I don't know. So they have and yet they're all sold through retailers. Now that's a tough thing to compete with, I guess.
It is. Yeah. So we have come up with a different model.
Yeah.
So the success of the model depends on time, of course, how that will prove to be. But
yeah.
Our goals were to build the best possible speaker we could, given our design principles.
Sure.
There are other principles to design and build, of course. Given our design principles, let's build the best product we can. It's mm-hmm. product focused.
Yeah, yeah. Yep.
Maybe I'm a little bit not up to speed with the marketing, but we have chosen this marketing philosophy. But I agree with you, Andrew. We're open to options.
Yep.
But I think we want to run its course the way we're doing things.
Sure.
And if it turned out that the price under the retail model was going to be much greater, of course, retailers can then discount, can't they? But under the retail model was too great, then I need to know, is our wholesale price, should we make cuts there? Would a cut in the wholesale price yep. mean a cut in the performance and the quality of the product?
Well, this is the thing. I always feel the sales pitch from the person who sells direct, the manufacturer who sells direct, is that, you know, you are paying more for, product and less for a salesman's wage. I've got a question here. Like you haven't really answered it, and I don't know that anyone can. But who do you really think your audience is for a Lenahan loudspeaker? What are they? Young, old, you know, male, female, music lover, hi-fi lover. What's the, you know, any thoughts on that?
I do have some thoughts on it. Given the price of the speakers, it's a reasonable investment, although nothing compared to a lot of the hi-fi out there. So someone who's a thinking person, I don't think not many people are going to drop, you know, $14,500 on a pair of a loudspeaker system just for casual listening.
Yeah.
So I think someone who loves music, for a start.
Sure.
I wouldn't have said this in the 80s.
The 80s?
No.
That's a while ago.
All the 90s.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
But those two decades, I feel the direction changed. Now I think people are moving back into proper reproduction of recorded music in the home.
Okay.
It's always been like that.
Yeah.
But I think the up and about mobile generation got in the way for a while. So I think it's quite straightforward. These speakers are for people who will curate a good system around them.
Yes.
And have the appropriate space to listen to them in. They're not a throw against the wall type speaker.
Yep.
And we'll lose sales because of that. Although we can do that because we have different port options, which we haven't spoken about today. So we can do different port options, including blocking and semi-blocking for closer to wall options.
Yeah, yeah.
But in general, they're designed as an out from the wall speaker.
Yeah.
So that's by its nature is going to limit a little bit our market. But that's the way to get the absolute best, most realistic, natural sound reproduction in a home space, without a shadow of a doubt.
StereoNet, StereoNet.com. If you're interested in audio equipment, and clearly you are, if you're listening to this podcast, then you should go and take a look at StereoNet.com. News, reviews, classifieds, and the forums, of course. These days, StereoNet is a truly international website with arms all over the world. Go to StereoNet.com today. And we're back with Russell Lenihan and the involved story of why his loudspeakers and his brother's are better than anything else. I'm being sarcastic, but I mean, basically that's the attitude you've got to take, isn't it, as a manufacturer?
It's the attitude you've got to take. Although you have to have some design principles, so you can't create the greatest thing ever under all circumstances. If you know what your design principles are, then you absolutely, yes, you can get into it and create the best possible, best possible speaker.
We've been asking every guest lately, what's the future of hi-fi? It's a loaded question, or is it unloaded? I don't even know what loaded question means anymore, because really it could be anything, right? Like there is, it's not loaded in the sense that, you know, it could mean anything to you or me. It could be the future of formats, like, although the format wars kind of run and won, isn't it? We just listen to digital files now, or records, or the old formats. Records being an old format, I guess. Records have won ultimately, really, it seems. And then there's all other technologies. Well, we've kind of classed D is maturing. There's GANFETs, there's that sort of stuff. We can talk about technology. But then there's the other things of like how people are going to listen, what they're going to listen to, what environment, how they're going to buy it, etc. So have you got, you know?
Yeah, well, there's always trends. And my opinion is trends are led by the younger generation, whatever that might be.
Sure.
And when I say the younger generation, that generation seems to be getting younger and younger. I've got a 13...
No, that's because you're getting older and older.
Well, I don't know. I've got a 13.
No, you're definitely getting older.
I am. I've got amongst my 10 grandchildren, I've got a 13-year-old and a 15-year-old, 13-year-old boy, 15-year-old girl, and they think they know, and they seem to know so much more than I ever did when I was 13 and 15.
Oh, no, I'm pretty sure they do.
They do, yeah. The access to things. So, you know, cultural trends are driven by many factors, but the youth seems to be the strongest driver in cultural trends.
Sure.
And we get old. When we get older, I go back to things that I find value in throughout my life. And good music doesn't go away. It's always there. And there's different ways to listen to that. There's headphones. There's, you know, the earpieces, et cetera, et cetera. But I truly believe that there's a place for people to listen to music in the home. It creates a different environment to watching TV or YouTube or on the computer or whatever else people do. It's a different mindset. It creates, in my opinion, it creates a different attitude and state of mind.
Sure.
Listening absolutely. To music in the home.
Yeah.
I think it's still part of the future. And we're trying to cater to that because, to be honest, our speakers are a reasonable expense.
Yeah, yeah.
They're not a pair of speakers you get from JB Hi-Fi. So,
hang on a minute. What if they end up selling them for you? You'll have to retract that statement in a future episode.
I don't mind retracting a statement at any time in the future if circumstances change.
The funny thing about JB Hi-Fi, which is a large chain of retail stores in Australia that I guess at one stage sold hi-fi. But they don't anymore. There's no hi-fi in there, is there?
Well,
the turntable range stops at $3.99 or something.
Yeah, they do have some speakers.
And they sell a lot of microwave ovens.
Yeah. Well, trends change.
And
I mean,
washing machines, you know.
Like. And businesses change with the market, doesn't it? So what I'm trying to do is How do I fit into the market? That's the question that every business person has to answer. And what's the niche we want to explore and sell into?
Mm-hmm.
And in my opinion, the quality reproduction of music in the home is still valuable. Not just to older people, but to younger people as well.
I guess. I mean, look, everyone listening to this podcast right now loves listening to music in the home. That's guaranteed. So you're kind of preaching to the choir a little bit on this podcast. How do you feel evangelistic enough about that ideal to somehow, I mean, how do you spread that to a broader audience? I mean, you must have attempted, you all have all these grandchildren to indoctrinate. You've attempted that, I take it, that you've got, have a listen to this.
I'll give you a quick example.
Sure.
My son Ben, who helps build the speakers with me,
mm-hmm.
Employed by us, he grew up in the 80s era, Pantera and Metallica and System of a Down and all those bands, right?
Yes.
Very loud music. He even took me to see the G3 concert, which was Joe Satriani. Fantastic. Absolutely loved it. It was so loud. When I say it was so loud, I was vibrating off my seat. I went back. Sorry, a side story. I hope this is interesting. I went back in this concert. It was so loud that I went back to the mixing desk, which is on the ground floor right at the back.
Yes.
And I said, too loud for me. And I said, one, can you turn it down? Not a chance. Two, have you got some earplugs? And they said, of course we've got earplugs. Gave me some earplugs.
He was wearing earplugs.
Of course they were. they were wearing everything. So they gave me some earplugs and I sat next to the mixing desk at the back of the hall and thoroughly enjoyed it. But the sound was so loud.
Mm.
I don't know how anyone could possibly enjoy it. But my son Ben loved it. That's his background. Now that he's come in to help build the speakers,
sure.
I've been educating him on accuracy of sound reproduction.
Okay.
The timbre of instruments, true dynamics. He listens to all things which are compressed. He is incredibly disappointed that all his old CDs, I won't name the bands, I've named some of them.
Yes.
They're all compressed. They sound terrible on a modern hi-fi system, most of those bands.
Yeah.
Because it's compressed and it's designed to simply keep people at an adrenaline level with no downtime. Whereas pure acoustic music, which is the standard, acoustic music in a real space is the standard that you want to reproduce, but that still has to play electronic music, of course, but the standard, the way developed speakers is develop them through real acoustic instruments in real space.
And that's try to make the recorded playback sound like the acoustic instrument.
Like the acoustic instrument. What we found out was that some of these files, because I stream, and CDs occasionally, but of these 80s and 90s metal bands, the sound was atrocious, absolutely atrocious. Could not be listened to, in my opinion. Perhaps my hearing's not so good, but terrible.
I think we've gone
and my
off.
Son goes, why does that sound bad, Dad? It's the speakers. I go, no, it's not the speakers. It's not the speakers, no.
Well, here's the quandary and the problem with hi-fi. And this is partly where I feel that some of these bigger bass driver, horn-loaded top-end contraptions that have become very fashionable all of a sudden do very nicely is that they have probably a fatter, more relaxed, less revealing presentation than say some of us would say a proper hi-fi speaker, and some genres of music and recording styles play back in a more enjoyable fashion on those systems. And I don't understand why the hi-fi industry turns their nose up at that in a way, because if you like that kind of music that your son enjoys, you want to hear it in an enjoyable way. And it's a fake recording of fake sounds anyhow. I mean, sure, a guitar sounds like that, but not without an amp and a bunch of effects pedals and, you know, et cetera. I mean, it's not an acoustic sound, right? You can't create it with an acoustic guitar. So so much of music is like that, though, and certainly most recordings, short of a pair of mics above an orchestra, are all, you know, made up caricatures of a performance. So why not choose the gear that sounds the most enjoyable to them? Because that's what they're going to do in the marketplace, isn't it?
Oh, but they do do that.
Yeah.
People do. If the scenario you just described,
yeah,
there's a market for that, and people do exactly that.
Yeah.
That's one sector of the market.
But you feel valid. You feel strongly it's wrong, though.
No, well, I don't. No, no, I don't feel it's wrong at all.
Okay, good. I mean, when I say good,
yeah,
I don't mean okay. I approve of your opinion. What I mean is, it's sort of. I guess. Are you saying then that because you said no, it's not. It's not the speakers. It's the recording.
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying. Yeah, but the recording's the fixture, right? You're stuck with that. So if you want to listen to Pantera XYZ album, there is only one, more or less one version of the recording. So
yeah.
If you want it to sound good, then you're going to choose the gear that makes it sound good, right? Which apparently isn't a pair of your loudspeakers. Is that what you're saying? Not to his ear anyhow.
No, I mean, and not to my ear.
Some people would enjoy hearing into the recording. I mean, that's where some very revealing loudspeakers I find quite instructive, that you can hear, you know, punch-ins and overdubs, and you can hear so much information in the recording that you can kind of hear quite a bit about the recording process.
Yeah.
But that's really not what most people want to do, though, is it?
I don't know what most people want to do.
Well, everyone wants to do something different, I guess.
They do. I do. So,
and on that note,
so, but as a business owner and manufacturer of speakers, we made a business decision to make speakers that, as accurately as possible, input signal going in,
yes,
coming out. Now, even then, that's not accuracy, because accuracy also involves the room speaker interface, and also the radiation pattern of the speaker. So it's not a simple signal going in. We want it to be accurate. We're making it as accurate as we can, but it's the accuracy is one, the translation of the electrical signal into an acoustic signal,
mm-hmm.
right? So that involves time and phase.
Mm-hmm.
And speed, of course, as a speed requirement. It's got to do it in time. So, but that's not the end result that comes out of the speakers.
Mm.
Why do headphones sound different to speakers? Because there's many more elements. So you can't control everything.
Well, you're taking the room out of the equation with headphones.
You've got a little room there.
Well, it's not much of a room.
No.
You couldn't put a very big lounge inside a pair of headphones. But
However, the space between your ear and the headphone cup is also something which different headphone manufacturers change.
Oh, no doubt. Yeah, yeah.
Yes, so it is. It's just...
But you are taking the if you work out the wavelengths involved in the space between the headphone diaphragm and your ear hole... technical term, versus that, you know, in this room even we're sitting in now, which is a small space, it's 100 times the wavelength, if not 1,000. So really, it's a much broader frequency range that's affected in a room than in a pair of headphones. But I get what you're saying. I always sometimes think, you know, that in an ideal world, you would sell not a customer a pair of loudspeakers, but you would sell them a box big enough to sit in with a pair of loudspeakers in it. And that box, of course, would be about the size of your average listening room, and it would be properly treated, not pretend acoustically treated like seems to be the fashion at the moment, where you put, you know, half an inch of foam on the wall, or maybe even an inch if you go crazy. And apparently we now have a treated room, and there's a future episode about just this, because I'm sick of hearing about it. this whole treated room thing is getting out of control, because in fact most of these treated rooms are not actually very well treated at all. They're just damped down at high frequencies and sound god awful. But that's for another day. We'll get back to that.
I won't enter into that conversation because it's a complicated one. It'll take too long.
It's super complicated. and I've been working on that episode for about 6 months. So when it finally comes out, it will be quite, in fact, it'll be a video, not an audio episode, because I have charts and drawings and whiteboard illustrations of why a treated room is basically bullshit, but we'll get to that. So, like, a completely untreated room is really, really bad, though. So, I mean, I guess, you know, there's a balance and a truth there somewhere. But, yeah, getting back to whatever the hell we were talking about, the future of hi-fi.
Future of hi-fi. We're talking about generations and...
Well, you were talking about how you were evangelistically going to approach converting people to appreciating listening to music at home. I mean, you're implying the future is that more people will listen at home rather than on the move. I actually wonder about that, because there's many bloody pairs of headphones sitting on people's heads. No one is walking along a pedestrian – well, not no one. The 80-20 rule is something I believe in very strongly, and 80% of the people I see on the footpaths I traverse every day on either a bike or – a wheel or a feet, all of those people going the other way are all, well, 80% of them are wearing headphones or have a, you know, inner ear device, earpods, yeah, what have you. All right. So I feel like there's more people listening to something than there has ever been.
Oh, I agree with that.
Yeah, okay.
I'm just saying there is still a niche for people to listen to music in the home.
Yeah, but we'd like it to be less of a niche and more mainstream, wouldn't we all, really?
Well, I've often thought about this, about whether the visual medias are peaking.
Yeah.
I can't say they are, but
well, some would say they're at an all-time low.
Thanks the to visual medias.
Yeah, thanks to Netflix and,
well, that's
and
visual,
the rot that comes out of Disney, etc.
Oh, sorry. Oh, at an all-time low in quality.
Yes, yes, yes.
But in quantity, it's very
high. Oh, it's at an all-time high in quantity. Yes, absolutely.
But if you look at things like the... I have a particular dislike for superhero movies, not because...
Well, we could start a club there, but...
Not because they're not well put together and well made. It's because...
Well, they're very well made, yeah.
They're very well made, but they're made bigger and better, and everything's bigger and better.
Yes.
And it's like, I think that people get saturated with excess, and I think... that many people eventually go back to the simpler things, the quieter as in less information things. I can tell you now, I'm going back to simpler music. Now, partly, and more acoustic music.
Yeah, yeah.
Although, wow, I love some electronica. Electronica's amazing stuff, all synthesized. But acoustic music is where it's at for me, and becoming increasingly more so. And I don't know if you recall... I'm just trying to think of the movie. Was it 2001: A Space Odyssey? It might not be the movie, but even back then, over time, people went back to listen to Bach, and it's simple modulations. Even though it's complicated music, it's simple in format.
I think there's a visual, like sugar hit or something, of those CGI extravaganzas of films, you know, which I guess is what Hollywood is spitting out of their sausage machine at the moment. But, yeah, there could well be a turn back to a simpler film, literally a sort of film version of a stage play with very few sets and scenes and actual acting skills and writing at the forefront rather than
It's
CGI BS. The same, I mean, it's fashion, right? So, I mean, there's a good chance that...
Well, it's American fashion, put it that way. It's not typically European fashion. So there's different cultures.
That's probably true, or is true. But there is, there could be a turn back to simpler music. But, I mean, does that imply that it has to be more simply constructed or simpler pieces of music to be appreciated at home? That's not really what you're saying.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that there's sufficient diversity and sufficient things in the big world, now that we're exposed through the internet, we're exposed to so much stuff that people can pick and choose their niche, their pleasures, the way they live their life, and music's part of that. And by extension of that diversity in music, we now have an extension of diversity in hi-fi, the means or headphones, the means of reproducing that music.
Yes.
Is also diversified.
Yeah.
And I'm comfortable with that. It's just as a manufacturer, as we explained before, what's my target? What's my niche? Who are we trying to sell? And selling is the bottom line in this instance.
Yeah.
Who are we selling to? How can we optimize that sale model to our audience?
Well, maybe you've effectively asked the audience that. So maybe they should answer. They can go to our YouTube channel, Not an Audiophile Podcast, and they can comment and tell you via us exactly what you should do, or they can go to your website, lenihanbrothers.com.au.
Andrew, I'd love that feedback. That's fantastic. Thank you.
Yep. Well, let's do that. As in, we've already asked people. Let's hope they can do it. People love giving their opinions across, and you should subscribe to us on YouTube and do just that. Not that you have to subscribe to comment. Hey, thank you, Russell, for an all-encompassing conversation of all things audio and all things Lenihan Brothers. I guess we thank Michael, really, for starting the whole ball rolling
a
long time ago. And you've, as he has moved into some kind of semi-retirement, I guess, you've taken on the mantle along with Martin. And good on you. Congratulations, and I hope it goes well. I know it's going well so far. So I hope it continues. Thank you, folks, for listening. Russell Lenihan, Andrew Hutchison, and I'll be back in 2 weeks. See ya.
Thank you.
Find the sound of your life by crafting a quality stereo system with The Hi-Fi Shop. Featuring all the brands you know and love. Riga turntables, Bowers & Wilkins loudspeakers, Exposure Electronics, amplifiers and CD players from the UK, and of course Sonos Faber loudspeakers from Italy. The Hi-Fi Shop helps you create your sound. Visit the team at hifishop.com.au.